All right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host Sam Moy and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our mind. We have a really special episode for you today. Lori Benton and Rohit Day are going to come talk to us about global legal history, about the way that thinking about legal ideas from a non-Western perspective can change the way we think about legal theory here and everywhere. So with that, let's get to it.
Well, we're thrilled today to invite on two of our colleagues to talk about global legal history and how it relates to American law schools and legal theory. Our colleagues are Lauren Benton, who's Barton Biggs Professor of History and Professor of Law at Yale, and Rohit Day, who's Associate Professor of History and Associate in Law at Yale Law School. Both of them are incredibly accomplished scholars. I'm not going to list their publications, but we're going to discuss forthcoming work in that they've both done. Lori is finishing up a book on the laws of war and the legal ordering of small war over centuries of empire, and she just delivered lectures to on that topic at the University of Cambridge, the George Trevelyan lectures. And Rohit has been doing lots of archival work in recent years for a project on what I think of as civil liberties lawyers and in the post-colonial world. And we'll get a chance to hear from them about those projects. But where I want to begin with both of you after saying welcome is by asking a question about the kind of present, the new presence of the kind of work you do on the radar. You know, when I went to law school, there was American legal history, and there might have been on some faculties someone who studied this shadowy prehistory and the common law of, you know, what we learned and taught in law schools, which was almost exclusively U.S. material. Now it's still that way. And yet there's slight change. There's comparative constitutionalism. And there are some people who know languages and who study other things. Although I'd actually say there's also more parochialism because a generation of European emigres has passed the scene. And so I'm just curious, just to begin, how each of you thinks with your stellar work of your relationship to the U.S. Legal Academy, because even as a Europeanist, I've struggled with it. And I wonder how you think about turning the Titanic, if you will, of the very parochial kind of thing that U.S. law schools put on. Lori, do you want to?
Sure, I'm happy to start. And thanks so much for inviting me to this conversation. It is true that we have come a long way. I remember when I first started going to the American Society for Legal History, we used to joke that it should be called the Society for American Legal History. And now, two decades on, it's a much different kind of forum with much more global work. But there still is a bit of a disconnect in the way that you've hinted between what has been this just explosion of work in global legal history and discourses, I think, in the American Legal Academy. I can point to one particular disconnect that concerns me, and that is that part of the work that's being done in global legal history, a big part of it is to identify a multiplicity of locations for the production of theory. So this is happening in among officials, it's happening among subaltern groups, indigenous peoples, not just elites, but others, So a lot of the research that's being done is identifying not just practice, but really the creation of legal theory in multiple locations, not just outside the US, but at many, many levels of interaction. In a way, I'd say that's one of the hallmarks of what we've been doing in the last couple of decades in this field. And yet, I think that's been slow to have an impact. It's been slow for people to understand it. As recently as maybe a year or two ago, there was an article by Andrew Fitzmaurice in which he complained about that what we were doing, essentially, all of us, was just studying practice, and that the real location for theory was among elites. And I don't know, perhaps you have ideas about how to get across that that is not, in fact, the project. We are indeed investigating practice, but we're also investigating these multiple sites of the production of theory.
I want to second everything Lauren said, but perhaps add a couple of sort of structural points. So, I mean, there is something about legal history taught in law schools anywhere that's inherently parochial. Part of the purpose is to equip law students with sort of historical information to sort of think with. But for most of the world, so whether it's European law school and definitely law schools in the global south, it's never an option just to do a kind of national legal history, because there is a sense of connectedness with histories of empire, histories of their neighbors, other legal traditions. So whether one likes it or not, one always has to engage with it. And secondly, I think this kind of relative parochialization of the American Legal Academy is a sort of new phenomenon. I mean, other people who studied it sort of argued comes into place in the 1970s, and it's partly a kind of question of personnel. So in the period just after the Second World War, you had a number of people who had either served overseas and had languages, and there were many people involved in a variety of development efforts, which meant that they were traveling out and engaged and interested and, you know, transformed by what they were seeing there. And when they came back, they sort of both brought in these comparative insights into the American Academy. And I'm thinking here of someone like Mark Galanter, who did sort of pioneering work in India, but perhaps in the US Academy is best known for his work on, you know, why the haves have come out ahead, or work on the legal profession, which was informed perhaps by the contrast that he saw there. And secondly, on Lauren's point about like who makes theory, I think that's a larger sort of argument we have to make, not just in the US Legal Academy, but in the Legal Academy overall, where there's a kind of quest to look for a certain kind of person who makes theory. It's usually a judge or a university-based academic. But I mean, Lauren's work shows it beautifully over a number of books. And it's very often, particularly when you're dealing with situations where legal structures are changing quite rapidly, it's people working at the kind of lower interstices of administration, or sort of subaltern populations coming in touch, who often end up producing or innovating ideas that might not at that moment look like theory, but have important implications for when we are sort of thinking of legal theory.
One question, and I'm going to come back to this because I am a bit of an outsider to this discussion. You all are global legal historians, and I am, you know, not. But one thing that struck me about your work and your answers right now is how focused they are on kind of public law or public law inflected topics. So if you asked what was happening in theory about corporate law, no one would say it's like exclusively being made in America, or it's being made by some kind of global elite for sure, but it's across place. And similarly, like antitrust. So Americans are now incorporating ideas about antitrust from Europe pretty dramatically. And so a lot of the new Brandeisian thinking is just European thinking with, you know, an Americanish gloss and some kind of history. And so it would not have occurred to me to think about And historically, the same way, a lot of the questions that animate these fields are certainly pan-West or OECD, but increasingly are focused on questions about kind of China or whatever in that respect. And so is the parochialism you identify really about kind of theory and public law, or is it, in fact, all of them? Because I would not have described American legal law schools as getting more parochial with respect to business-ish topics.
I, Actually, I think that's a very good point and a distinction worth making. It's certainly the case in the history of international law that people who are doing private international law are much more aware of the openness of the law to all kinds of, you know, meeting points between theory and practice. I think that is absolutely correct. At the same time, too, I think it's worth pointing out that in topics of public international law, there has been a lot of common ground where historians and lawyers have both come to regard sovereignty as malleable and fluid and changeable and at times discursive, and so there are these points at which there's a lot of alignment. What I think we find though is that there's some incremental change, and particularly I would say in public international legal history, where, for example, if you think about what was regarded as an almost radical move not that long ago to say that indigenous elites were participating in the making of international law. But that participation was really characterized and dated as late. As coming from a moment when indigenous elites or non-European elites were reading Vattel and beginning to argue about the boundaries of territory and on the basis of international legal concepts. Before that, what are they doing? They're not participating? I don't think that's the case. So I think some of also what I would like to do is to suggest that there's some value in lengthening our historical lens so that we're including longer periods as well as deepening our discursive kind of sites and modes that we're paying attention to. But I think your characterization is right.
So I want to maybe add a caveat to that, which is, so there's clearly a kind of a global world of private practice in some matters. And again, scholars like Brian Garth and Eve Desilets show this is partly a result of a kind of like Chicago consensus, post-91 American power, which leads to lawyers, whether they're in Japan or New Delhi, essentially working with like New York or Delaware rules. So, you know, while you're looking at like debates around private practice in other jurisdictions, they're essentially working with the same debates and presumptions. I think what might be interesting to look at is where, when we look at some of the new emerging critique in the US, there are sites that have done this critique before, either in sort of like state-led ways. So there's work on, you know, particularly after countries become independent, how do you sort of regulate state-run corporations? How do you sort of decide on questions of bidding? How do you allocate resources in a kind of unequal society when you're giving out, say, government contracts, right? So, and we see those questions appear in sort of American legal debate now, but there are other places that have thought and experimented with it, which don't become part of the conversation. And I think the second question is a kind of story about to sort of challenging this idea that there's something that happens, say, in Chicago and then sort of moves elsewhere, to look at like other ways in which ideas travel. So just to give an example in private law, the British are unable to pass a contract law in the UK, a codified law of contract in the UK in the 19th century, but because they have the power, they're able to do one in India. And then this Indian sort of model law of contract moves across different former British colonies. So it's not so at one level, it's a story of like, okay, the British give this code and it moves along. But when you start reading the commentaries on the code and the critiques on the code, you see a sort of range of voices appear that make sort of important contributions to it. So I think some of this gets missed out when we just see the kind of post-91 conversation around private law globally.
No, I was just going to jump in to be more optimistic than pessimistic, I think, because I think in a way the big story is, in fact, a lot of change and a lot of widening of our lens of what we're examining. I mean, really, when I think about what was available to read in English 20 years ago, on the legal history and theory of places outside the Anglo-American world, It was not a huge volume. And now it is an enormous volume. I mean, the field has exploded in a way that really we're still, I think, in effect, trying to get our arms around it. It's been moving in so fast and in so many different directions. So it's more of a good story than a bad one, I think.
Well, let me just intensify my pessimism just so I can get even further pushback and kind of distinguish between some ways there might be globalization, because we've kind of run a lot of different possibilities together. So first is in personnel, like who's teaching in the law schools, who's getting hired. And I personally would venture to say that there are actually probably more people born in the United States teaching in US law schools now than before. And that doesn't mean they can't know a lot. So there can also be globalization of topics. But and I think David has pointed out some of that in private law. And I just want to concede that we're in a golden age of comparative constitutional law, where 25 years ago, people wouldn't have been that interested in global constitutional law. Now they are, and some of them know a lot of wherever they're born. And so these things don't have to run on the same tracks. And again, if you look at foreign law faculties, they're much more global in their composition, even as they've also probably gone even further than American law schools have in kind of what they talk about. What this conversation is about in part is global legal history. And here, I think, you know, what I've noticed in my short time in the Legal Academy is that, you know, U.S. legal historians got their positions and made bids for relevance by learning to talk in a certain way and frame their topics in a certain way that have kept kind of global legal historians on the outside of the mainstream conversation. And that's what I was getting at. And it's not to say there aren't other conversations or that there are more panels at ASLH that aren't about the US, but I'm worried that there's still kind of an impervious or impermeable boundary in the kind of, you know, Yale Law Faculty Lounge and many other places that makes the rest of the world in the past seem of pretty faint relevance to what people like the central conversation. And I wonder if that's, you know, valid, and is it terrible as I think it is?
Well, one thing, you know, my mother used to say to me, you can't account for other people's behavior, dear. You can only count for your own. You know, I mean, at a certain point, we can just keep writing things that we think are good and useful and important and hope that people in the that you are describing in the American Legal Academy will like to read it at some point. I don't think it's just a problem of the American Legal Academy. There is also, as you know, a really strong doctrinal tradition in legal history in Europe. And so that is something that is also changing around the edges, but still, I would say around the edges. But again, I don't know how to either account for what you're describing or even think about what to do about it. I will continue to do my work, and I hope Rohit will continue to do his, and we'll hope for the best.
I share your observation, Sam. I'm not sure. I'm just to give an example. So there are certain structural constraints when you're trying to become relevant. So when I was I first came to the US and I was at the law school, I did a kind of survey on what's being written about India in American law journals, and about 90% of all articles focused on two things, which were marked out as like oddities. So unamendable constitutional amendments and the kind of existence of Muslim family law in a sort of secular constitutional structure. And it was repeating the same arguments, but they clearly were of interest to law review editors. So every time a new article came up, it would sort of get picked up. But these are not the only two or the most interesting or the most relevant topics if you're sort of thinking of the Legal Academy. So I feel there are limits to what one can do to become legible. And secondly, I wanted to say the other shift that's happened is I think history departments and social science departments in general have been more receptive than, say, sort of formal law schools. And there is a burden that they've overcome as well. So there are a number of people who have deep skepticism about, you know, where the law tells us anything more than power or elites, or some years ago would be quite impatient with even the kind of like doctrine-like work that many of us do. And I think they've been more welcoming. So what one hopes is perhaps more engagement with history in general will produce sort of lawyers who are willing to listen.
So let's explore, you know, these kind of like broad themes in the work that each of you is doing, and, you know, how it could affect, or why you think it is relevant to, you know, not just history departments, which I think you're right, Rohit, have globalized, you know, the study of law in a way much more than law schools. But also, you know, could have a lot of relevance for, you know, so-called legal theory. So Lori, you've given these lectures and are preparing a fantastic book on the legal regulation of small wars and continuities in that regulation, not just over centuries, but into the present. So could you take a minute to just tell us, you know, what the project's about and what the main kind of claim is?
Sure. A lot of my work in the past has focused on, you know, asking fairly open-ended questions about what kind of law, what kinds of legal relationships were guiding interpolity relationships on a vast scale. And I've worked a lot on empires, but I'm equally interested in the way small polities and other sorts of political communities do this, particularly in beginning around the 1500s and going forward from there. So I focused a lot on European empires, but I'm really interested in the genesis of global order and how that comes to be, and how do we talk about law in relationship to global order. And I thought that I had probably not paid enough attention to legalities of violence in my earlier work. And so I began this project just asking, you know, a sort of big open-ended question about what patterns of violence can one suss out that we have not regarded sufficiently as legal in character, and how they influenced both emerging international law and global order. So it was from there that I got to the topic of small wars and small violence. Really, that is an unfortunately inadequate label, because I just don't have a better one, to describe a whole variety of kinds of violence that are really on the threshold between war and peace. And so things like raiding in the 19th century, measures short of war, what we come to call measures short of war, and a variety of kinds of violence that's going on, sometimes inside empires, sometimes on the margins and beyond the boundaries of empires. And so I just wanted to ask, you know, how is this, what is this legal phenomenon? But I also did not want to write this as if it was a history disconnected from discourses about the law. And so I actually, in this project, go back and forth between kind of histories of the social history of violence and these patterns of violence, and trying to look from a different perspective at commentary in the writings of what we would regard as kind of canonical European legal writers, from people like Grotius, but also the Scholastics, and in later periods Bentham, and so on. And so that's the project. Right now, I can talk about the answers to the project, but I also don't want to go on ad nauseum, and you should ask me something more.
Well, so we do want to get into the specific theses, but let me just ask a kind of threshold question about how you think about what law is, because a lot of the project is describing patterns of behavior, and you show that, you know, potentially, you know, important or not important writers register that and reflect on its legality. But it could be that you could imagine a book that just describes the history of small wars, however defined, without mentioning the law. But it seems like a lot's at stake then in your claim that there were legalities of small war. And so, you know, which isn't proved by the fact that some guys wrote some books about it. So could you just explain, like, what's legal about the legality of small wars as you're trying to illustrate it in these stories?
Well, that's a great question, Sam. And I think that it's important to say that one of my concerns is how to write about international law before international law. There is a long period of time, really, depending on how you clock it, but I would say before the last quarter of the 19th century, when there is no recognized field of international law, there is not even a group of international lawyers. How do we talk about law across polities before that period? And of course, one possibility is to just look at a sort of story of what people have been writing about the law of nations from the scholastics on, and that's how you get the story we're all used to. Vittoria begat Gentili, who begat Grotius, who begat Pufendorf, and so on. Or you need to do something else. And so, along with some other people, we've been trying to characterize what we describe as interpolity law, and we see it as organizing itself around some fairly big categories of legal action, in particular jurisdiction and protection. And these are categories that we can say we can find evidence of being recognized and talked about and struggled over in just about every society, human society, from in the early modern world. So that's the object of study, right? Interpolity law or interpolity legalities. Now, once you start looking at things that way, it really becomes very clear that the idea of custom as we've imagined it is excessively narrow. And it's often just contrasted to written law. It's often, better than I, perhaps, how custom gets characterized. But this is a world of law. That is, as people interact across political boundaries, they are recognizing legal authority. They recognize jurisdiction and fight over it. They make arrangements of protection, which have legal characteristics to them, which I can describe in more detail. And they engage in a whole lot of other actions, which do, you're quite right, that part of this has to do with actions that repeat so frequently that they become expectations of behavior. And so there is a way that legal anthropology has been very, very influential on this thinking, at least on my thinking, about interpolity law.
So one question I had about is I couldn't figure out exactly how much causal force law was having on behavior in your chapter as opposed to law being created. And so something I thought about was the early 2000s, kind of a high point of neoconservatism, Max Boot puts out a book called The Savage Wars of Peace, which is about exactly the same topic you're talking about. And I think he gives a very similar account, which is like, this is something kind of empires do and hegemons do. Now, of course, he thinks it's good and you're kind of being implicitly critical, or at least, but he's like he's a cheerleader for it. But like the story he's telling is like, this is commanded by your kind of situation in the global legal order, the global power order, not even legal order, the global power order. I couldn't tell whether law is doing anything different in your account. I mean, he's focused on American wars, but like he suggests it's the same as the English. There are a few things like the English leaving a person so they could come back and invade or whatever, but that doesn't seem to be having too much causal force except for like it has some effect on the people who were left in wherever. But is law actually doing much in your story as opposed to being produced in your story?
I'm going to have trouble answering this because I don't tend to think exactly like that about law having a causal force or not, but I'll do my best. I think that one of the big takeaways from not just this project on violence, but other work that I've done is to see that Europeans in the early modern period until the long 19th century are really doing interpolity law much like other people. That is to say, they're not doing, in particular where violence is concerned, they're engaging in a lot of raiding and captive taking, and there is a regularity to those practices that is law-like in its nature. There's also a legal narrative at the same time about why those activities are lawful. And so the theory and practices I was describing before don't sit in different, they are slightly different registers, and yet they are parallel. They have a strong family resemblance that you can see. So in a way, the way I like to think of it is rather than trying to identify where the causal arrow goes, is to think about these activities being just shot through with law. They are structured in a way that gives them the quality of law. And it's not until you get to the 19th century where I think you get the kinds of things that Max Boot is writing about, although I really do not want to be describe myself as the junior Max Boot, because, of course, not just his book, but a lot of the literature on small wars just veers into basically becoming manuals of counterinsurgency.
It's all over. You're now the Max Boot of legal academy. it's happened already. I'm sorry about that.
So, Lauren, if I could just jump in, I had a question about sort of sources and how to read them. So, what your work does, I mean, not just here but in other places, is you know, there's a kind of UN model of comparative law, which just sort of adds two more names in the mix. And what your work actually does is shows it's not just about adding like more color or more names, but showing how there exists this kind of like legalish regime over a larger place. So I was wondering, how do you decide what to include, and what does one do with the fact that some of these texts are written and then sort of disappear and are not picked up on in the immediate sort of future, whereas other texts sort of become hegemonic and travel. So when you're sort of writing about them now, how do you put these in conversation with one another? And, you know, to in a kind of legal framework, like what precedents matter and what don't, and how do you recover kind of a forgotten precedent?
This might be partly the benefit of not being trained as a lawyer, that I get to not worry about certain things, and precedents might be one of them. But also, it's an opportunity to say what I return to again and again as a kind of core methodological approach, which is relevant to Sam's earlier comments, I think, about comparative constitutionalism also. Is that I like the comparative method when I do the comparative method. However, I am not really interested in differences. And that, I think, is one of the things that, in addition to finding fault with the American Legal Academy, one might find some fault with global legal history, too. I think sometimes we focus on the great diversity of cases and examples and societies, and we catalog their differences. And I just don't find that one gets much traction that way. So what I like to do when I do these comparisons, I don't want to say that the cases don't matter, because they do very much matter. But, you know, you can get a lot out of cases that are serendipitously chosen, because you happen to come across something in the archives or because you have the languages to look at them. And the comparative method I like is, of course, when you put these disparate cases side by side, instead of saying this is how they differ, this is how these trajectories depart, you say, what can I see in each of them by placing them side by side that is different? And where do I start to see larger patterns? And so when I think about global legal history, I really have an emphasis on the global. I want to see very big patterns that really start to give us a way to tell a completely new story about narratives of law and particularly narratives of global order. That's my main interest. And that's really how I go about sort of thinking about these cases and how to deal with them.
Okay, that's a perfect kind of setup for at least my last question, which is really about, you know, notwithstanding, I think the much more important continuities that you just, you know, defended as our main topic in thinking about the legalization of war, whether novelty ever matters. And here I just want to invite you to kind of, you know, say a bit about the collegial and small wars you're initiating against some Yale colleagues, and that would include Ona Hathaway and Scott Shapiro and me. Not that we need to debate, but really that, you know, I think that you've said something incredibly important about the, you know, whether, you know, events in the middle of the 20th century by, let's call them, warmongers making peace, I think that's your phrase, something along those lines, make as big a difference as some think, or whether the alleged humanization of wars on terror or the war on terror recently has made as big a difference. So I just want to, I mean, because it can't be just be a matter of your interest that continuities matter and novelties don't, because we still need to know, well, what's the importance of those continuities? What endures? What changes? What gets overlaid? How is the continuity transformed? And so will you just say something about how you want this project to speak to the 20th century and indeed the 21st, and what novelties you would acknowledge, if any?
Well, thanks for the question. And the scope of the project itself, the meat of the project, I should say, is 1400 to 1900. And yet here I am writing in the 21st century. It is impossible to ignore the relevance of these kinds of questions for what's going on now. And the main point of critique or difference that I think you were signaling is that I think because I can identify this much longer preoccupation with trying to define the lawfulness or the of a certain kind of limited permissible violence. And I'm interested in the kind of long trajectory of these different attempts to frame low-level violence as permissible. And I see that occurring from, you know, the 1500s on in different ways, and I'll get to the differences in a second. But that is a kind of structural component, I would say, a structural element of the global legal order. And in that regard, I do not regard these issues that have bubbled up with the war on terror as novel, right? It's because they are structurally situated and structurally created. Now, I don't say that they couldn't be different in some way. What I do characterize in the project is two kind of broad, I call them global regimes of violence, one focused over a long period of several centuries on raiding and captivity, and the other on what I call global armed peace. When I'm looking mostly at the British Empire and other European empires in the long 19th century, when they're developing this way of doing small wars that really gives them open-ended license for short, brief interventions, not humanitarian in nature, the vast majority of them. And so I do see a lot of continuities between that global regime and the present. However, we might be going into something different here. I don't quite know the answer to that. I don't see as many differences and as sharp differences as you and Ona and Scott see. I don't see that pivot in the mid 20th century, or you place it in the Vietnam War, as being quite as sharp as you do. And this is important. I do not see the small wars of the late 20th century and the 21st century as a return to sort of a colonial war that's outside the international order, that somehow is not lawful or contained by law in any way, because you know, most of the book is about these really strong efforts to figure out what is the legal framing of what makes small violence permissible in these earlier periods.
So I'm not gonna, you know, keep on this because we really want to turn to Rohit, but I just want to disentangle two issues in what you've said, because I think it's really important to me personally, in part because I really want to distinguish myself also from kind of excessively progressive and triumphalist narratives of international law. But on the one hand, you've got an incredibly powerful critique of, let's say, you know, transatlantic or just American internationalists bringing peace, because it's actually an armed peace. And it's, as you say, it's in continuity with and allows a lot of small wars in continuity with the past. So, you know, that I'm completely on board with that part of it. When you say that, you're also concerned about stories that about law-free zones in these small wars, and the lifting of law as the main problem rather than the continuities in the actual legal order. I guess I just wonder, do you really not think in the early war on terror, just for a couple of years, it's significant that George W. Bush's actors had to struggle against the applicable legal framework, which, you know, folks involved in small wars, their lawyers had not had to do before. And that's what invited all these ideas about, you know, Giorgio Agamben and Guantanamo and law-free zones that were allegedly being established. Because that was the predicate for what came after, which was, you know, in the late Bush years and in Barack Obama's presidency, like restoring the legality of small wars. And you and I can debate like whether how much violence remained in that, but it's not like anyone is still arguing that the whole war on terror is like outside the law. And so I guess I don't completely understand who you're arguing with on that point, unless there are a lot of kind of Agamben followers that I've missed.
I do appreciate that I might have misrepresented some of the, or not captured in my very brief remarks, the nuances of your argument. I recognize what you're saying is not that it's a return to, you know, all out lawlessness. And yet, Sam, you do use sort of Indian wars as this paradigmatic example of a kind of lawlessness, whereas right. I see them shot through with law. And, you know, down to the moment when you look at individual actions, people are writing back to try very hard to explain why they are lawful. Now, of course, is some of this just hypocrisy? Yes, some of it is hypocrisy. Is some of it legal cover? Yes, some of it's legal cover. But it repeats itself to the point where I think we can talk about it as actually constituting a kind of structural order that protects these low-level instances of law. That's the main point I would come back to, and I recognize the nuances of your argument as being different from the maybe extreme.
That's a very fair critique. Very fair critique.
So I think we should pivot here, and I just need to start. We're going to talk into some of the substance of the argument. I think we should start just kind of at the basic. Rohit, could you tell us a bit about the Law and Modernization Project and what its ends are, and how your work fits in, broadly speaking?
Sure. So maybe I'll just start talking about my work and then how the Law and Modernization Project sort of emerged as a kind of fulcrum there. So I was interested in a couple of things. One that sort of by the mid 20th century, South Asia had the world's second largest population of lawyers outside of the US, and their wasn't any way in which this fact was sort of taken in as a way to understand ideas, society change. And secondly, was a kind of increasing sense of unease with the new work that was coming out on human rights. So whether it's sort of international human rights, but also sort of national constitution making, which really focused on instruments or on sort of theoretical texts or judgments. So in the kind of sites for production were often seen as assemblies of the UN, where, you know, when the rest of the world participates, it participates as sort of states. Or within sort of certain kinds of like courtrooms and university bodies. So the way these two come together is I really wanted to sort of tell a history of how, and you know, we can debate about what it is, but rights, civil liberties, political lawyering changes in much of the world by looking through the kind of long career of a number of lawyers. I sort of began with looking at figures in India, but it became clear that there's a larger kind of legal space where lawyers of South Asian origin moved to East Africa, Southeast Asia, and the Caribbean. Caribbean lawyers were moving to East Africa. The Anglophone Chinese lawyers in Southeast Asia and the Caribbean. And of course, there are Europeans and Americans who move in and out of the narrative. And then I suddenly discovered that three of our protagonists were in New Haven in the 1970s, in a way that's not remembered in any of the tellings of Yale Law School's history, or not discussed in detail when there's sort of accounts of their careers. And at this point, you know, there's so Yale Law School had this program in law and modernization, which was funded by USAID. It ran for about 10 to 12 years. It ended controversially, partly through sort of internecine faculty battles over what the law school should do. And just last year, there have been some sort of good oral histories of this that have come out. So, and these have been written by key figures in the critical legal studies, law and society movement. So Dave Trubeck, Rick Abel, Brian Garth. But with the exception of Boavera, D'Souza Sancho's, it's been largely a kind of American story. And the accounting of the story has really been looking at, okay, there was a kind of alliance between Cold War liberals, sort of radical lawyers who were dissatisfied with American legal education. And there was a sort of space created in the law school. And in the end, the kind of Yale Law School sort of forced out the law and modernization program. And many of these figures sort of moved to other places to become sort of founding figures in CLX. But what's absent in the narrative is the fact that over this decade, there were around 30 or 40 legal academics from Africa, Latin America, and Asia who were here at Yale. And they produced working papers and used that time to work on their dissertations or sort of larger research projects. And I'm not bringing this up to suggest that Yale Law School is necessarily formative in their careers or that they come in and they get infused by modernization ideology, but to suggest that there are a number of figures operating in the legal academy in the 60s and 70s who are being read, who are listening, and work is conceptual and sort of empirical work is being produced as a result of this conversation, which sort of gets missed out, even though the working papers are there in the Yale Law School library. I mean, they don't get checked out much. So I think the sort of broader impetus is to look at who makes up the legal academy and the legal profession in the latter half of the 20th century, and how do we take the work that they do and the ideas they generate as part of a larger conversation, which it always was, but we seem to have sort of lost.
Yeah, so my question, again, coming from the outside of this a little bit and a little bit less focused on Yale specifically, but is how surprised should we be about this history? So if I were to tell a completely naive story about the Indian legal system, it would be something like Britain, when Britain leaves, it left India with a kind of super strong bureaucracy relative to the size of its economy. And so this is like leads to the license raj and all of this stuff that it has a hyper-developed bureaucracy relative to its level of economic development. And what would spring from that is that we should have lots and lots of lawyers and that there were lots and lots of lawyers who, to navigate this complex bureaucratic system. And then if I were to tell a story about the legal history of the Indian diaspora around the world, it's like a commercial elite throughout Africa and Asia, and it this leads to conflicts like in Uganda, like really bad stuff. I would also expect there to be a hyperabundance of lawyers because like that's what you need to do to be a commercial global group, right? So your comparison to Jewish lawyers has a very similar flavor here, which is like if you're doing international banking, you need to have lots of lawyers, completely independent of their relationship to the state or whatever. And so to what extent should we be, I mean, it would also then be surprising, I think, if this huge number of lawyers were having no influence or no discussions, engaged in international business in one hand and in, kind of at the center of some global political fights, you know, non-aligned movement, all that jazz, were not like talking to people in, I guess, New Haven or wherever in New York or in London or whatever. So is this a story of surprise or is it surprising that we didn't pay attention? Like what am I supposed to be surprised by?
Great. I think you did the kind of schematic narrative really well. So I think there are three things, I agree with some of the description, there are three things which stand out. The first, of course, is why this engagement has sort of been forgotten or if it's remembered at all. It's a story of like, oh, some people came and traveled and did their own particular project. It doesn't have any bearing to a kind of larger history of ideas or movements. The second is that the kind of development of the Indian legal profession, of course, is connected to political economy, but it develops with a lot of resistance from both the colonial state, which is sort of appalled that there are all of these lawyers running around. In fact, part of that experience is why they try not to set up law schools in East Africa and Malaya, because they don't want a large population of native lawyers. And similarly, the post-colonial state keeps saying that, lawyers are sort of interrupting the work we're trying to do. We had a wonderful constitution. Lawyers have kidnapped it. What we need is all of these sort of, you know, that we've moved to decolonize law by creating sort of populist legal forums, sort of restoring old village councils. And one of the more interesting works that comes out of the Law and Modernization Project is by Sri Lankan lawyer Niran Thiruchelvam, which is called The Ideology of Popular Justice in Sri Lanka, where he looks at Sri Lanka's experiments to create these informal legal systems. And I mean, there are two things that he points out. One is that these informal systems essentially take on strong legalistic characteristics, and the removal of procedural safeguards actually make it sites of other kind of violence. Thiruchelvam, of course, is a Tamil lawyer, later on becomes a kind of key figure in finding a kind of constitutional solution to the ethnic conflict, and is assassinated in 1999, just months before he's supposed to return to Yale to sort of escape, to get away from the kind of political change there. So if I wanted to sort of briefly sum up, I think legal profession, when it's studied, is usually studied through two lenses. One is a kind of political economy sociology story, where lawyers are seen as just an output of capital, or in a kind of, if you sort of look at Owen Fisher's recent book on like legal liberals, a kind of heroic individual story where there are these, you know, unique people who emerge and sort of like do really brave things. So how do we find a way to sort of look at the work lawyers do in between that? So a couple of ways is that, you know, the work on corporate law or the work on private law is not separate from political work. The best example is Gandhi, who goes to South Africa essentially as a kind of transactional corporate lawyer and slowly becomes a kind of spokesperson for Indian rights, labor law, a number of other things. And for many of the lawyers I'm looking at, I mean, while I look at figures who do political work, in some cases I would just go to a place and ask, if I was arrested in the 1960s, who would defend me? And it would be the same three names. So this work occurs alongside other kinds of work that they're doing. So they're also doing white collar crimes and they're also doing corporate law. And for them, one part of the work subsidizes the other. So if you think of the kind of critique that comes around the NGOization of human rights, I mean, critiques from both the right wing, which says this means it's foreign influence, or from the left, which says, you know, this sort of changes the nature of work. This older model of lawyering, where it's working out of like individual or family firms with a mix of work that they're doing with one subsidizing the other, tells a different way to sort of challenge these usual divides we have between public and private and between human rights law and corporate law, and maybe sort of explain better what's happening in other places. And I'm happy to talk about this at length later on, but I think it also changes the genealogy of certain things that we take for granted. So,
you know, I love the chapter. I just want to make one note and then ask a question that kind of goes in the direction of the answer you just finished. I mean, the note is that in a way, the law and modernization program is late in a story of the formation of post-colonial lawyers in metropoles, even in Eastern Seaboard ones. I mean, I was struck in doing a tiny amount of research on kind of in international law and the attempt to decolonize it in the 1960s, just how many of the kind of visionaries in the field, like R.P. Anand, were Yale or Harvard products. And it, you know, there's some story to tell about how within imperial histories, one might have studied in London or Paris, but in a post 1945 world, Harvard and Yale became kind of central locations long before, you know, David Trubeck founded things to kind of train up and then do interesting things. But what I want to ask is about the kind of telling individual stories, because where Laurie's, I think, bid for impacting kind of, you know, the mainstream legal theory debate, which is, you know, the official purpose of our podcast, is sort of to say the stories you're telling are not capturing the continuities in empire, and they're in a sense self-serving in precisely that regard. You're telling a story that could be taken to be familiar within, say, civil rights history. You know, there are these lawyers who, you know, come through elite spaces and strike a blow through cause lawyering. They're up against a lot of odds. You distinguish the story from that, but you very much defend telling a story about individual lawyers or maybe a cohort of individual lawyers. So what do we take from that? That's a kind of general critical theoretical importance. Just one more time.
Thanks, Sam. So I think part of this is a challenge to think about how to write about legal histories from other places where the same kind of obvious sources don't appear, or if they do, they aren't preserved, right? So if you're working on American civil rights lawyers, what you have is from the early 20th century organizations that have records, you have regular publications, you have well-preserved courtroom documents, and you also have a committed number of people with tenured jobs in the academy who are sort of writing, theorizing, and studying these figures. When you sort of turn to other places, these sort of institutional records, documentation doesn't exist. And also many of these figures are not following uniform trajectories. So, you know, I would describe them as civil liberties lawyers, but they're also doing other kinds of work. So they don't fit into this kind of neat separation that in some ways the American historiography and civil liberties lawyering, which is early, sets it almost as a kind of normative framework. And there are a few things that come as a result of this, and I'm strawmanning, so, you know, please feel free to correct me, right? So on the one hand, it's the, okay, so from the, you know, John's work suggests that in the 1920s, John and Lauren Wynum suggests that the kind of international discourse of civil liberties had to be retrofitted to fit the American constitutional system. So internationalism bad, let's become constitutional patriots. In the 1960s, there's a kind of turn towards the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's a kind of privileging, given American politics, of like civil liberties and political rights over social economic rights. But when we look at this landscape of people, they are using a variety of sources. So even in systems that have constitutions, there's kind of happy drawing of comparative law or an international law. And this is sort of where Lauren's work is really useful, because I keep wondering why are they not sort of committed to a source or building necessarily constitutional patriotism, because there is a kind of instinctive sense around there are certain kinds of rights that, you know, broadly the law or the common law protects that we can argue through multiple ways. And I think the second point is that this also means that for many of these figures, the kind of strategic choices American civil liberties organizations had to make, these aren't relevant, right? And in some ways, there's almost a kind of, many of them work and represent trade unions while also doing civil and more traditional civil political rights work. They also confront with states that are dispossessing people in the name of social economic rights and not dispossessing elites, dispossessing sort of indigenous tribal people. So there is a kind of, you know, both suspicion and also like social economic rights have always been accepted. So maybe what we need to do is sort of focus on civil liberties now it's coming out. So I think that changes and in a way pushes away at the kind of civil liberties model. The second bit was about, you know, where stuff is made. So I think some of the more interesting work coming out, and I'm thinking here of John Harrington, Amrina Manji's work on African law schools that are set up in the 50s and 60s, mostly Ghana and Dar es Salaam. So they become a meeting point for people in European academia who are finding doctrinal law sort of unappealing. So figures like William Twining, they have all these sort of American dissidents like Pauli Murray or, you know, South African dissidents who are escaping out of apartheid South Africa. And they have a number of sort of South Asian scholars who are sort of moving in. And in both these campuses, the law school is very much seen as part of a decolonizing project. So I sometimes find that when there are these contemporary conversations about decolonization of the legal academy, at a kind of empirical way, I was like, it might be interesting to look at what law schools did 50 years ago when they were actually trying to move out of a colonial state and sort of see the strategies that followed and what worked and didn't work. So these law schools become sites of producing interesting scholarship. The one kind of paper I've been trying to write forever is the first constitutional textbook in Ghana is written by Pauli Murray and Leslie Rubin. Pauli Murray, of course, a familiar name. Leslie Rubin is a Jewish liberal, anti-apartheid South African lawyer who was in exile from South Africa and Ghana at that time. So what does it mean for two figures coming out of two very different kinds of social movements, in some ways in exile from their home countries, sitting in this kind of new republic of promise, trying to write a textbook in constitutional law that Kwame Nkrumah ultimately doesn't like very much, right? So trying to think of like sites of legal production and the kind of ideas that are generated.
So one thing that your chapter made me think about was the kind of broader work of people called like the World Society scholars of kind of global sociology, who noticed on how countries copy one another really dramatically. And the most famous example of this is like every country in the world has an army, a navy, and air force, including landlocked countries or countries without airplanes. And this is really true in constitutional law, that like once constitutions start to see particular rights, they show up in all constitutions, whether they're wherever they come from. So the right of the child starts appearing at some point. And this has been incorporated in American law schools by Ryan Goodman and Derek Jinks, I think, most notably. And so one question I had was, in your description of these kind of, again, global legal fora, or is that the forum for the creation of this kind of like, are you describing the creation of this kind of global society model where ideas are both constraining domestic things and are very much global in the sense that they are like not responding to local concerns particularly at all, at least on the books? So it can be equally true from a critical as well as from a kind of traditional hegemonic perspective, because like there are things that emerge in the global South that then move to, you know, Canada or whatever. Is that the kind of thing you're describing? Because it kind of seems like it is, again, for good or for ill? Question mark.
So I mean, if I give that impression, maybe I should correct it. So that's not what I meant by global spaces. In fact, many of these campuses, when they're set up, are set up with the kind of idea that personnel that come from a lot of different places, and we might use materials from different places, but we're clearly not trying to do what institutions elsewhere do, and they very much see themselves as part of projects of national sort of social change, which means the kind of questions that the law schools take up are very different. So in Tanzania, a lot of it is about how do you nationalize land and property? How do you deal with like state-owned corporations? In the Indian Academy or in the Malaysian Academy, a lot of it focuses on how do we engage with sort of family law systems and sort of resolve questions of identity versus questions of equality. There is, of course, a kind of shadow that the American and British legal academies cast, but they're trying to do very different things. So in the African law schools and in India, there's a very strong sense that law schools must teach social and political context. So they hire historians, sociologists, economists. They require compulsory courses in sort of social and political conditions in East Africa or in sociology, which was not the case for British lawyers or British legal training for the last few years. So, and in some ways, the kind of people who become influential later on in the British or the American law and context movements sort of discover this or are allowed to do it first in Dar es Salaam or in Ghana or in Addis Ababa. So William Twining, for example, is in Dar and Ethiopia and then sort of finally makes his way back to Warwick and sort of brings out law in context as a kind of series. So I think these are spaces that are set up with, some of them succeed, some of them fail, to create a different kind of project, which is trying to address conditions in the global South, but they become sites of interaction of a lot of people sort of floating.
Rohit, could I just, is there time for me to ask one question?
Please.
because I thought it was very nice that early in the chapter you identify that part of one of the things that you're dealing with is this problem. And we could think of it as a theoretical problem, I think, also of what happens when law travels. And it isn't just that, you know, people are, as you put it, sort of carrying volumes from one place to another, or trying to impose what they know from one system on another. But this kind of open-ended question about how we analyze that traveling and the meanings of the traveling. I mean, really, so far, the only person I can think of who's done that in a way that I find, you know, so compelling is the person you cite, Issa Hussein, who shows that the result of a lot of traveling of Muslim law in the Indian Ocean world is a peculiar result, which is that Muslim law begins to get jurisdictionally more confined and more closely identified with family law. It's a really interesting argument. Are you hoping or planning or finding that there's another kind of an outcome like that in your study, an answer to the question of what happens when law and these lawyers travel?
Thank you so much, Lauren. So I haven't reached the answer yet, but my instinct is I hope to see something like that. And it sort of goes back to the question David was asking, right? So superficially, we see it's a kind of argument, every country has a flag, every country has an army, every country has a Supreme Court that cites these precedents. Are these precedents therefore, you know, a part of a global conversation? And I think when you sort of move away from just a kind of final author judgment to focus on, okay, why did the lawyer even bring this up? Where did they get the precedent from? What did he or she seek to achieve by using it? You get a kind of different story where even though a Westlaw search says, well, this case was cited in like Nigeria, if you kind of look at the actual work that goes into citing, you kind of get, you might get a different sense of what that precedent of the citation had to do. So just the appearance of the same thing in different places doesn't necessarily mean it's a kind of homogenizing of forms. But I haven't, partly the pandemic stopped research, so I haven't worked out the answers yet. But it's something that I'm hoping to find.
Great.
Well, it's been an amazing conversation for me. Even though we only scratched the surface of these two great scholars' forthcoming work, and just hinted really at the riches that are out there in global legal history that I think everyone ought to kind of know about. So thank you both for your time.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rohit and Max. I mean, Lori.
Thanks again.